From California to Kentucky, Alabama to New Mexico, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Trump administration has outlined a policy agenda for regulating the development of artificial intelligence. Neil Chilson from the Abundance Institute is here with details. With a major holiday rapidly approaching, the U.S. Senate has been unable to resolve funding for the TSA nor pass the Save America Act. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Long lines at airports resulting from U.S. Senate Democrats' refusal to approve a new Homeland Security budget has given rise to the possibility of privatizing the TSA. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine and Steve Swedberg of the Competitive Enterprise Institute explore the idea. And the national debt has hit a record high in record time. Former Congressman Keith Rothfuss has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Congress is considering how to regulate the rapidly growing artificial intelligence sector. The White House has now provided some guidance. For details, we turn to Neil Chilson, the former chief technologist for the Federal Trade Commission. He is now head of AI policy at the Abundance Institute. Neil, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Neil, the Trump administration has come out with a broad range of policy or policies designed to get a federal handle on the very rapidly developing artificial intelligence industry. Can you give us an overview as to what the administration is proposing?
The Trump administration has been building to this moment for a while. Even in the first Trump administration, President Trump created some frameworks for how the federal government would deal with AI that were very pro-innovation. And as soon as he took office on the second term, he reversed some of the actions of the Biden administration, which I would characterize as largely fear-driven about the technology, and very much determined that the U.S. is going to be the leader in artificial intelligence, because it's going to continue to do that. And he's taken a bunch of executive actions since then, and that's built up to this moment. There's only so much that the president can do without Congress to set up a national framework. And so this release that they came out with last week is a national policy framework for what Congress should do in order to keep us at the lead while dealing with the concerns that people have around artificial intelligence. And so it has seven different sections. These include protecting children and empowering parents, safeguarding and strengthening American communities, which touches on some of the issues around data centers and electricity prices, respecting intellectual property rights and supporting creators, preventing censorship and protecting free speech, enabling innovation, educating Americans and developing the workforce, and then finally setting up a framework for how the federal government and the states will split up the responsibility of governing AI. And so it's a very substantive document, even though it is quite short. It weighs in on every single debate that's been going on in Congress around how we should regulate AI, and it provides the White House's perspective for how that debate should go. So this is kicking the ball into Congress's court, where for federal legislation, the ball should be, and saying, here's how the White House thinks this should go. And obviously, Congress will have to take up the ball from there.
A number of states, Neil, have been moving in this area on their own. What do you see as the appropriate level, the appropriate relationship between what state governments are trying to enact and what the Trump administration and where the federal government should go to from here in terms of regulation of AI?
The states are extremely active. About 1,600 bills introduced to regulate AI in some way or another since January. And those bills have a wide range of issues. And so I think the right way to think about the divided roles here is that, you know, states should deal with problems that are local, to the state, that raise specific concerns that are unique to the state. And the federal government should set policies that have national security implications, that have nationwide commercial implications. And there's a whole bunch of the types of state laws, especially that California and New York Illinois have tried to do in this space that would essentially create national frameworks, even though those state legislators are obviously not elected to do that job. And so that's, I think, the right way to think about this. National issues should be dealt with at the national level. They should be dealt with by Congress. More local concerns, there's an important role for state legislatures to deal with those. Ultimately, however, though, this is a space of innovation that's being led by the commercial sector. The amount of investment, the jobs created to build out these data centers and these tools are very commercially driven. And it is that edge. That's what's giving us the edge globally on this. And so I think we need to, when we think about the types of problems that we want to solve, we need to very much focus on specific harms and figure out how to address those harms without slowing down the great innovators that we have building the AI-empowered economy that is going to take us into the future.
Congress has historically, Neil, in many areas, developed a regulatory framework and then sort of left it to bureaucracies to fill in the details. There's been some pulling back of that in recent years with court cases and the Trump administration. Is there a danger here that Congress could create another federal bureaucracy that could once again get out of control and put regulations on the industry that really shouldn't be there?
That's always a risk with federal regulation. It's also, I would say, a risk at the state level as well. And, one thing that the Trump framework does say here is that there is no need for a new agency to regulate AI as a unique entity. Artificial intelligence is a general purpose technology. That means it can be used across all industries. And we have a lot of industries that are already regulated quite heavily by specific agencies. And so to the extent that the use of the general purpose tool, say in healthcare or in transportation, raises new issues that aren't already addressed, many of them are maybe overly addressed in some of these regulatory frameworks. But to the extent there are new issues, a sector specific approach is right here. We don't need a new overarching computing agency or artificial intelligence agency. Because in effect, that would become an agency that regulates the entire economy.
Neil Chilson is head of artificial intelligence policy at the Abundance Institute. Neil, a bit for us about the Abundance Institute. Also, where can we find you on the web?
The Abundance Institute is a nonprofit think tank. We are very focused on emerging technologies. We think that technology has been the primary driver of widespread human prosperity. That's been the trend over the past 200 years, but we know it doesn't just happen by itself. It takes a culture that embraces innovation rather than fears it. We focus very much on artificial intelligence and energy. Those are two areas that are obviously very entwined. And you can find out a lot more about our work. Check out some of our YouTube videos. You can find all of that at abundance.institute.
Neil Chilson of the Abundance Institute. Neil, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, I guess maybe you've been standing in some long lines at airports since you travel a lot. Looks like TSA and airport travel over the upcoming holiday break could be a big issue here.
Absolutely. And I think we got to remind the listeners today how exactly we got to where we are. And we had a continuing resolution fight in the fall where we had the longest federal government shutdown of all time. And instead of pushing things to a lame duck omnibus where the Democrats would have increased leverage to extend the Obamacare subsidies and so on, there was a deal that extended federal funding through January. And over the last 40 plus days, the Department of Homeland Security got siloed out of the continuing resolution because the Democrats were more concerned about coddling criminals that were under the scrutiny and the enforcement of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, also known as ICE. And so what we instead have seen is the Democrats holding the line, saying that they're not going to fund our Department of Homeland Security because they want to make sure that we defund ICE. And there's been this long, prolonged negotiation, and now we're seeing these long and prolonged wait lines at the TSA checkpoints and airports. And travelers are getting really frustrated. When I was in the airport recently, you see the media cameras, and they've got their lens focused on how long the line is and how long the wait time is going to be. And so this week, the Republicans in the Senate said, oh, man, we gotta do something for our people. Let's just make them an offer. Let's fund all of TSA, all of Department of Homeland Security, except the Immigration and Customs Enforcement provisions. And you know what the Democrats did? Well, they couldn't take yes for an answer, and instead they said no to that offer, and they countered it with an additional proposal to try to ensure that there would be numerous reforms to ICE. And the Republicans said, well, why would we reform an agency that isn't even being funded right now? And Republicans are trying to figure out, can we do a second reconciliation bill to handle this additional war supplemental to fund the operations in Iran and to fund ICE and to do other things that I think many members of the Congress want to look at. But the Democrats are demanding reforms to an agency that they refuse to fund. And that's not a negotiation in good faith. There was reporting recently that came out of the Democrat caucus meeting where the Democrats said, hey, the Republicans are the ones that are actually losing in the court of opinion. They're the ones that are in power. But I think that a lot of people recognize that we had the Schumer shutdown of the fall, and this is the Schumer shutdown right now of the spring and of spring break. And those long TSA lines, we're watching video of travelers that are saying that this is all Chuck Schumer's fault, and he needs to come to the table and end this stalemate with the Republican Senate.
So we have this going on, Scott, and the Senate also has been grappling with the Save America Act. There's been a lot of debate on the floor about that. Has any actual progress been made toward passing that particular piece of legislation?
It's a great question. And I think about how inconvenient those lines are at the airport for so many travelers. And the problem with the United States Senate Republicans in advancing this shared priority of the Save America Act and voter ID and ensuring that only U.S. citizens are voting in American elections, the problem is that they have not made it inconvenient for the Senate Democrats. They're still holding the votes during the middle of the day. The people that are speaking late at night are Republican senators, not Democrats. They never agreed to do the so-called talking filibuster to make the Democrats hold the floor, to make it inconvenient, to hold votes at 3 a.m., and ultimately to pass the bill with a simple majority. The Senate often operates under what are known as unanimous consent agreements. And there are numerous unanimous consent agreements that have been set up over the past 2 weeks while we've debated the Save America Act. You think about the confirmation of Mark Wayne Mullen to be the new Secretary of Homeland Security. You think about the consent agreements to allow the Senate to adjourn at 11 p.m. and come back the next morning at 10 a.m. Those things are all done through unanimous consent. And until we have Republican senators that are willing to stand up and block unanimous consent agreements and also to lean on the leadership to actually try to utilize a talking filibuster and make the Democrats show up and filibuster legislation, until that happens, I just don't think that you're going to see the national interest in this story the way that it would otherwise captivate the American people's attention. And right now, there's much more of a focus on the long lines at our airports than there is on election integrity and the Save America Act. I think that's unfortunate. I think that the strategy can change. I think that we can add the DHS appropriations bill to the Save America Act, and then we can force the Democrats to filibuster the legislation through a talking filibuster, not through niceties that the U.S. Senate traditionally operates under.
While members of the Senate are scheduled to go into a recess here in a few days, Scott, any talk about them maybe like staying in Washington and getting the job done rather than leave all these major pieces of legislation hanging, letting long lines at the airports continue? Possibility the Senate might stay and actually get things done?
Well, I think there's a very strong possibility that the Senate will stay. I think that it wouldn't look good for them to show up at the airports and be skipping the lines while you've got millions of travelers for spring break and Easter that are having to wait. And the real question is, can they get things done? And that depends on a strategic vision that needs to be outlined by the Senate leadership and coordinated with the White House. President Trump has said, hey, why don't you guys stick around? I got an idea. Bring all your families to the White House for Easter. Well, a lot of senators took that as a threat, not an invitation. And I think that they do want to have a resolution here. And the question is, does that get done by April 5th and Easter?
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, give us a few words about the Club for Growth.
Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. We have over 525,000 members from all 50 states in America. And our membership is united in this idea of economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity. You can actually visit clubforgrowth.org and sign up and become a member for free to learn more about the hard work that we're doing to defend economic freedom.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. As always, Scott, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Twice in 6 months, budget disputes have resulted in TSA agents going without pay, causing long lines at the nation's airports. Is it time to privatize the agency? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Steve Swedberg of the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Long security lines are snarling travelers' plans at airports all across the country, and this is all kind of downstream of that partial government shutdown, a situation that we've been in since the middle of February. The Department of Homeland Security is currently officially shut down. That means TSA agents are working without getting paid. Yes, they'll get back pay almost certainly when this gets resolved, but they're working without pay at the moment. Many of them are calling out, and that's causing some travel chaos. Could we solve this by getting TSA just out of the government entirely? That's the question I'll put to my guests today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. That guest is Steve Swedberg. He is a policy analyst at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He joins us now on the phone to talk about this. Steve, I hope you have not had to travel over the last couple of weeks. I understand things are pretty rough out there right now.
No, I have not had the displeasure of having to deal with airport security in the past few weeks.
Well, we are glad to have you here. If you can, give us a little bit of a survey here of exactly how bad the situation's been. I know last weekend it was like one of my colleagues was actually stuck in New Orleans for something like 4 hours in a TSA line. We've seen some crazy long lines in Houston and some other places. How bad is it out there?
From the looks of it, I mean, I was seeing reports of various airports now advising that you should get there 3 to 5 hours in advance. In terms of the absenteeism from the TSA employees, on peak days, it's getting to 12%. So you're talking like anywhere up to like Reuters was reporting at like over 3,000 officers missing a given day. And even New York Post just posted an article yesterday saying that it might have forced entire airports to shut down.
Yeah, the situation is bad, and it potentially could get worse. We've actually heard like Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said over the weekend that things will get worse in the coming days and weeks if there's no resolution to the budget fight in D.C. Steve, that fight, the DHS funding situation, is really a totally separate thing. It has to do with holding up funding for ICE, for immigration enforcement. Has to deal with some disagreements there over ICE tactics. But TSA gets caught up in this just because it's part of DHS. And this, I mean, in some ways, maybe this goes back to a mistake that the government made, 25 years ago after 9/11.
I absolutely agree with that. They created the TSA in rapid time and in crisis mode right after 9/11, about two months afterwards. We went from having airport security in the U.S. pretty much be privatized to being federalized and under the TSA. You don't have these issues in other countries like Canada and UK. There's government oversight of the airport screening, but the actual screening itself is done by private entities. So, you don't run into those issues. And as for whether it's safer, Cato Institute put something out that it's either as safe, if not safer, than it is with having the government running airport security.
We're talking with Steve Swedberg. He is policy analyst at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. You can check out his latest piece on this. Shutdown woes show why it is time to privatize the TSA. Steve, okay, look, if private security can get the job done and if it takes it out of the budget process, I feel like that just makes a lot of sense. What's the opposition here? What's the reason why we can't just take this, or what's the reason why we haven't so far, at least, taken TSA and moved it out of DHS and resolved this whole situation?
You have institutional inertia, which is common with a number of government programs. Once you create it, it's really hard to undo it. And then you're also going to get political resistance from unions. You're going to have status quo interests. And when it comes to airports, they might just prefer the devil that they know rather than make the change. But hopefully, I'm trying to be optimistic that the growing frustration at the airports and all the airtime this is getting in the news cycles will put pressure and reopen the debate.
I guess as a libertarian, I feel like I always have this sense of like, well, of course the government just shouldn't do this thing, right? We should just privatize that function or this function. So I feel like I do fall into that trap with this because I just dislike the TSA and I feel like there are ways we could improve upon it. But it sounds like, and as you mentioned in the piece at CEI, that this is not really as radical or as untested of an idea as it might seem. I think to many Americans, it probably does sound a little bit radical, but this is something that that a lot of the rest of the world already does.
Correct. Yeah, much of the rest of the world does it. And for those of us who can remember air travel before 9/11, this is the way it was done prior to 9/11. And the federal government allows for about 5% of airports right now are under the screening program under the federal government that allows for it, the biggest one being San Francisco. So San Francisco is airport isn't dealing with these problems right now that much of these other larger airports are dealing with.
Yeah, that's right. We've already got a trial program out there. Something like that could be expanded. Certainly, there are solutions there if Congress was interested in looking for them, although I think that's probably the biggest stumbling block here. That's something we could talk about for another hour and a half, Steve. Unfortunately, we don't have that time today. Thank you so much for taking some time and walking us through all this.
Thank you, Eric. Have a great day.
And once again, that is Steve Swedberg. He's policy analyst at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. You can check out his latest piece at CEI.org. Shutdown woes show why it is time to privatize the TSA. I could not agree more. Privatize it. Get it out of the government so we don't have to deal with the mess that we're seeing right now. And it would probably work more efficiently, even at the best of times. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out our coverage of these ongoing issues and everything else happening around the country this week at Reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The national debt has reached another record high, and the deficit is growing at a rapid pace. Former Congressman Keith Rothfuss talks about the impact on this American Radio Journal commentary.
During my first campaign for Congress in 2010, the national debt for the United States approximated $13 trillion. That year, the expanding debt was an issue that helped propel Republicans to take over the House of Representatives with a net gain of 63 seats. There was a lot of energy within the Tea Party GOP those days to stop the profligate spending that President Obama had taken to an art form with his 2009 stimulus and the promises in his unfunded and unaffordable Affordable Care Act. The Obama years were on top of robust spending during the guns and butter George W. Bush years. In that era, even though the nation had embarked upon the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the Bush GOP increased domestic spending on items such as the No Child Left Behind federal education experiment and the new Medicare drug plan. But with the Tea Party wielding significant influence after the 2010 midterms, then Speaker John Boehner achieved a remarkable feat for conservatives, an actual reduction in federal discretionary spending in 2011. Such fiscal discipline is but a distant memory. Now, 15 years later, the national debt has soared $26 trillion, putting us $39 trillion in the hole. Trillion-dollar deficits are now accepted as routine, and neither political party has much to say about this new status quo. If you do not think that's a problem, look at how much the federal government, in turn we the taxpayers, are paying to finance the debt. Net interest on the debt in 2010 was $197 billion. This fiscal year, it is projected to be $1 trillion. That is $140 billion more than we are spending on defense. Why does this all matter? We all saw several years ago what can happen when federal spending spins out of control. The $2.2 trillion CARES Act in 2020, the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan Act in 2021, the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill in 2021, and the $900 billion so-called Inflation Reduction Act in 2022 all contributed to the worst inflation in more than 40 years. Crimped family budgets across the country have yet to recover. And now, here we go again. This fiscal year, a budget deficit is projected to be higher than last year's, $1.8 trillion. But wait, that's before considering the next big-ticket item. Last week, news began to circulate that the Trump administration is teeing up a funding request for $200 billion to pay for the Iran war. That's a lot of money, particularly in light of some politicians characterizing the action in Iran as not a war, but a, quote, limited operation. Given our budget mess, Congress needs to scrutinize this war supplemental with precision. In the fiscal year, after the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, Congress passed a supplemental appropriations bill allocating $20 billion to fund the global war on terror efforts in Afghanistan and elsewhere. On inflation-adjusted terms, that $20 billion would be worth nearly $37 billion today. In 2011, with 150,000 troops stationed across Iraq and Afghanistan, supplemental funding was close to $159 billion, or $229 billion in today's dollars. That sounds close to the administration's request, but in 2011, we had tens of thousands of troops deployed in two theaters. I recently suggested that given the unprecedented scale of the attack on Iran, President Trump should have first sought congressional approval before entering this war. Had he done so, Congress could have considered every angle of this undertaking, including the end goals of the action, the likelihood of achieving such results, and the potential casualties among our service members. Congress could also have raised concerns about the economic consequences of this war, from the impact on the federal budget to costs arising from the economic disruptions sure to take place in the energy sector. But the decision to wage war was made without the input of the people's representatives, and now we have to pay the price. The question lawmakers now face is whether the war will be paid for by cutting other spending, raising taxes, or putting it on the nation's already overextended credit card. Knowing how Congress operates, the last option is the most likely. But someday, maybe in the not-too-distant future, the bill on that credit card will come due, most likely in the form of more inflation. While some politicians may think that they have dodged a tax increase on the American people, others will understand what Margaret Thatcher taught 50 years ago. Inflation is the cruelest tax. Get ready to pay more. This is Keith Rothfuss for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KWFM-FM in Wichita Falls, Texas, WSBP-LP in Woodbridge, New Jersey, along with WBNL-AM in Boonville, Indiana. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the cost of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.